Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a mass shooting, this time in Rock Hill, takes the life of a well-respected physician and four others. We have the developing details. Vaccine eligibility increases to include anyone 16 or older in North Carolina, as some COVID indicators look hopeful and others remain troubling. Good news for several former Tent City residents. The city earmarks $2 million in funds to house them for a year and provide job training. Georgia experiences backlash on voting legislation. Sound familiar? Crime in Charlotte is down, but gun crime is on the rise, and UNC gets a new basketball coach, while the Panthers' decision on a new quarterback raises some eyebrows. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE health reporter Claire Donnelly. Good morning. Welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Glenn, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hello to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Katie Peralta-Soloff is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Welcome back. Good to see you. Speak.
Good to see you,
yourself.
Too. Sorry about that. I was on mute.
Well, now we're all here, and all of our mics are on. That's always dangerous. Another mass shooting this week, but this time it occurred in York County on Wednesday afternoon when a prominent emergency room doctor, his wife, two of their grandchildren, and a worker at the doctor's home were shot and killed. Another worker was wounded. Trent Ferris from the York County Sheriff's Office told WCNC-TV that Dr. Leslie was a fixture in the community.
I've lived in Rock Hill my entire life, and Dr. Leslie was my doctor growing up. So that's how this is kind of a little hard on me. But Dr. Leslie has been one of those people that everybody knows. He started Riverview Medical Center in Rock Hill, and it's been a staple in Rock Hill for years.
Dr. Leslie was 70, his wife Barbara was 69, and their two grandchildren, Ada Leslie and Noah Leslie, were 9 and 5. The fifth person identified as 30-year-old James Lewis, who was working at the home at the time. What else do we know about this shooting? Katie, or Eric, go ahead, Eric.
Go ahead, Katie.
I probably was going to say the same thing as you. I think there are still so many unknowns in this horrific shooting that happened the other night. And I think that the question that everybody is wanting to know is why. Motive is still unclear. The York County Sheriff said yesterday that they did not determine a patient-doctor relationship. So we just don't know what drove Philip Adams, this former NFL player, to do this. I think that's something we'll be looking for.
The manhunt for the shooter went on for about 8 hours, because this all started at about 3 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon. At 1 a.m., I think they had a search warrant and entered the home of a neighbor whose son was identified as the shooter, the alleged shooter. Am I wrong in saying, or have they changed this since I read this, that there was a doctor-patient relationship between the father of the shooter and Dr. Leslie?
I don't know the answer to that question. One thing I was going to add to what Katie said is I believe the father of Philip Adams had speculated that maybe injuries from football. He obviously played in the NFL, that maybe injuries from football played a role in this, which I thought was interesting. And obviously we don't know that yet, but that will be something that I think that will be an area of further examination.
According to Alonzo Adams, he's the father of Philip Adams, who is allegedly responsible for this and who took his own life early Thursday. Philip Adams was an NFL player. The parents lived near the doctor's home. His father, Alonzo, went on WCNC-TV and said he believed, as you said, Eric, that football played a role in this.
Well, I can say that he's a good kid. He was a good kid, and I think the football messed him up. You know, I don't think he ever did anybody any harm. Well, all I can tell you, we pray for the family.
Adams played 78 NFL games over five seasons for six teams, including the San Francisco 49ers. I think he was there for about a year. The New England Patriots, the Atlanta Falcons among the teams he played for. During his career, he did have a couple of surgeries on his leg and other places, but he also had a few concussions, I believe. Is that what his father is referring to there?
That's what he's referring to. And this, for football fans are familiar with CTE, is the condition that so many football players have had, and that's been studied and is continuing to be studied in terms of the repeated collisions on the field. Mm-hmm. And it has been linked in the past to mental health problems and emotional problems. We don't know if that's the case here, but his father clearly thinks that played a role.
And
I talked to people who knew Philip Adams, and I grew up in Rock Hill, and none of them wanted to talk on the record, of course, at this point anyway, but they said he struggled with the fact that his NFL career was over. And that he wasn't more successful about it. They also talked about the injuries. They talked about the injuries, but they also talked about the kind of emotional and psychological struggle that he had after leaving the NFL.
And as is so often the case, and I'm not saying there's any connection to this, but this morning, if you read stories about him from fellow teammates over the years, he was described almost universally as a loner, someone who did not mind being by himself a lot, even while on teams. And that seems to be a psychological profile that comes into play a lot of times. With this, Dr. Leslie, the late Dr. Leslie worked for decades, as Mr. Trent Ferris said about him in the community. As an ER doctor, he founded two urgent care centers. He wrote a weekly medical column for the Charlotte Observer for a time, and a book called Angels in the ER, based on inspiring true stories. And that's a developing story that we'll continue to be looking at. It also made the national news. The good news this week, I guess, is about, believe it or not, the coronavirus pandemic. It's finally beginning. The good news in that is finally beginning to outweigh the bad. Vaccines have been rolling out for months. The number of people getting shots is increasing. At this point, Claire, how many North Carolinians have gotten either one or both of their vaccination shots?
Yeah, so we know that 73% of people ages 65 and older have gotten at least one dose. So that's good. That was kind of a focus, obviously, kind of getting people who might be more likely to get seriously ill. I think total North Carolina's done more than 5.5 million doses, which is a really big number, hard to wrap your brain around. But you're right. It's good news.
And beginning this past Wednesday, Governor Cooper announced that all adults 16 and up are now eligible to get vaccinated. And that puts this state ahead of President Biden's goal of allowing all U.S. residents 18 and older to get vaccinated by beginning April 19th. Why are we ahead? We talked about the difficulty of getting vaccines here for such a long time. Why are we now ahead?
Yeah, so I think, it's kind of what we talked about this, I don't know, the last time I was on, where the state has sort of been saying that they're taking the temperature of providers. So how ready are providers to get these doses out? And we're getting more supply also. So they're hearing from providers, we've got the doses, we need people to give the doses to, and now we're getting more and more doses. So, yeah.
Yes, supply of vaccine is outstripping demand at the moment. What should we read into that? Simply that we have been flooded with vaccine, or that people are reluctant to get it, or don't know how to get it, or can't find a way to get it? What's the story there?
Yeah, I think that's something that I think public health officials are going to be kind of looking at going forward. How many people want to get vaccines but can't get them yet. I don't know. I mean, I do know that this week, an Atrium doctor was saying that he feels like there will be appointments available for anyone who wants one within like the next 2 to 4 weeks. So I think it may also be just getting those appointments up and accessible to people. Glenn, were you going to say something? Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Oh, yes. I was just going to say there was at least one demographic that we should note that is running behind in terms of vaccinations, and that is the Black or African-American population. In fact, It is, according to the state dashboard, it is the only demographic that is not tracking in terms of population. About as of their most recent numbers, of the people who are at least partially vaccinated, only 17.2% identified as Black, and that compares with 23.1% of the population that identifies as Black.
Is that because access is more difficult for them? They can't get the vaccine places, or they don't have access to the web? Or is it because of what we've talked about many times in the past, this suspicion of this vaccine or anything coming from the government that has to do with medical stuff?
I suspect it's a combination of all of that. I'm less familiar with what's happening outside of Mecklenburg than I am with what's happening locally. I know that locally, Atrium and the county and some others have done an outstanding job of hosting pop-up vaccination events within using facilities at African-American churches. That's where I was vaccinated. I was able to drive up. There were very few people. It took me probably less than 15 or 20 minutes to get vaccinated.
And that's what I'm hearing, too, from people, and with my experience as well. You make an appointment. When you go there, you don't have to wait. You just you actually walk in or drive in, and they give you the shot, and you wait 15 minutes to make sure you don't have a reaction to it, and you drive away, and it seems really painless, except for the point of contact of the needle in your arm.
Well, at these drive-up or at these pop-up vaccinations centers in Black and brown communities in Mecklenburg, appointments aren't even required. You can just drive up. So it's really super easy. It's difficult to say why that population is not tracking with the others.
But Governor Cooper this week urged officials around the state to make a concerted push to get more people vaccinated, because he says every time we wear a mask, that makes a difference. Every person who gets a shot makes our state safer and healthier and helps the economy recover.
If we all do our part, we can put this pandemic in the rearview mirror once and for all.
So there has been this hesitancy on the part of some, not just those in the Black community, but also among some healthcare professionals, to get this shot. Is the hesitancy, I know we just talked about, they're the lowest group of people in terms of the numbers of vaccines they have received, but is it changing? Is it improving? Is the reluctance lessening, Claire?
So one thing that we've been hearing during all of these conversations around hesitancy, going back to kind of the beginning of how will we convince people to take this shot, is that it can also have kind of a snowball effect. The more people that you know that get the vaccine that don't have serious side effects or that have minor side effects and recover, and you know, the more that you will be encouraged. And we also heard from Governor Cooper and State Health Secretary Mandy Cohen this week that it's really important for people to have leaders or members of the community that they know and trust pushing the vaccines. And so I think that was part of the press conference that he gave this week too, was encouraging local leaders, as Glenn was saying, well-known pastors, well-known church officials, well-known members of the community, kind of getting it, pushing for it. And Katie, sorry.
Well, I was going to say also one thing that we've talked about on this show, and Claire, you've reported on this, I reported on this, is the distribution to primary health care doctors. Mm-hmm. And that's something that state health officials are really emphasizing as a point of of concern, because they want to make sure that people are, you know, get the vaccine from a trusted source they can talk to about.
And we stop there. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Claire Donnelly is here. She's our healthcare reporter for WFAE News. Katie Peralta, Soul Officer reporter for Axios Charlotte. Glenn Birkins is founder publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Claire, you did a story this week about what we should expect Now that more people are eligible to get a shot, Mecklenburg County Health Director Dr. Meg Sullivan, addressed concerns this week about side effects from the vaccine.
If you do have those post-vaccination side effects, it's just a sign of your immune system responding to the vaccine. They usually start about 12 to 24 hours after the vaccine and only last for a couple of days and then go away.
But now yesterday in Wake County, Wake County and UNC health officials paused the administration of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. And this is happening elsewhere in the country because of adverse reactions. How long, what kind of adverse reactions did people experience and how long did they last?
Yeah, so this was only, I should say, according to Wake County, at the Wake County site, they had given out, I think, 2,300 people went to get their Johnson & Johnson vaccines there. They gave it to 2,300 people. Mm-hmm. And about 18 people had adverse reactions. 14 of those were apparently, according to Wake County, treated on site and recovered. And then 4 people were sent to the hospital. And as of yesterday evening, all but one of those people had been released. So the side effects were fainting, lightheadedness, dizziness. But the majority, according to the county, according to UNC Health, the majority of these side effects were normal side effects associated with the vaccine. I think only one was an allergic reaction.
The Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a one dose vaccine. Does that make it more potent in some way? And therefore you might be more likely to react to it, or do you know?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I would think no, but also one thing that I was reading this morning, someone had interviewed a UNC health doctor, and he was sort of wondering if maybe people who are a little more hesitant around needles are opting for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because it's a one-shot deal. Yeah. And so then, he was just kind of asking the question of, is this actually caused by the vaccine, or is it because people who are getting the J&J shot don't like needles and are feeling faint? It is worth noting when I talked to Meg Sullivan that she says, if you are a little wary around needles, you should try to make sure you eat something, drink some water to sort of avoid feeling faint, because you haven't eaten.
Glenn.
Yes, that was actually what I was going to touch on. One of the CDC recommendations for that vaccine is that you breathe slowly and deeply before getting the vaccine, and think of something relaxing.
Couldn't we have a pregame Krispy Kreme? I know you get one afterwards, but maybe that'll solve it.
Well, they tell you to eat something before you
go. I don't know about the heart rate, though, Eric.
That's true.
So, in fact, Dr. Ryan Shelton, a physician with Trion Medical Partners, believes that people over-worry about the side effects, and he had this advice.
I think people over-focus and over-worry about the side effects. You can't change what your body's going to do, and you need the protection from the vaccine. So I think people need to try not to be too worked up about it and too nervous.
And I have to say that people's reactions seem to be very individual. My personal experience was the first shot, my arm was going to fall off 24 hours later, but then it went away. And the second shot, I didn't even feel the shot. Even the after effects of the shot, while other people that I know had chills, etc. So it's an individual thing, and it's your body reacting to, it's your body doing its job. It's reacting to this foreign substance and building up resistance, which is how it works. You are not getting COVID when you feel bad after the shot, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And actually, I did want to point out about
Were you
the
checking?
Wake County.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I did want to point out about the Wake County thing. We should say that last night the CDC and NCDHHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, investigated this and said that there was no reason to continue pausing the J&J vaccine. Wake County tweeted that they had to make an early decision about whether to continue to host the clinic today. So they opted for Pfizer, but they see no problem going back to J&J going forward. So,
and then there's the question of what to do with the card that they give you when you get the shot. You need to keep track of that card.
And what we recommend is that people hold on to that. And that if they think they're going to lose it, or maybe even if not, to take a picture with their phone just so that they have a record of it.
Those are the recommendations of Mecklenburg County, Medical Director, Dr. Meg Sullivan. But there is there's one thing that almost every official says not to do with that card, and that is do not laminate it. Why not?
That's interesting. I don't know. Well, I haven't heard about the.
Well, I do. I know
okay,
the answer.
Go.
Because, like a lawyer, I ask questions I already know the answers to. It's because you may have to go back for a booster shot in the future, and you would take that card with you, and they would add that information to the card, and they can't do that if you laminate the card. So, taking a picture of it and putting it on your phone is a good idea. And of course, that leads us to the question of. These passports, because that would kind of be your passport, although it may become more official with a barcode and things like that. Since vaccine supply is for the moment exceeding demand, and with opening those vaccination opportunities to more North Carolinians, the governor says the state is now focused on getting people vaccinated as quickly as possible, with an eye toward the very near future. Actually,
we are working now on a prediction of where we think we're going to be leading up to July 4th based on the information that we have now.
So if that prediction is accurate, where would we be? What would life look like? Would we be normal again?
The million-dollar question. I think there's been a lot of, you mentioned the vaccine passports. I was just going to say there's been a lot of back and forth on that. It's gotten more politicized than I expected it would be. Governor Cooper initially came out and said that they were looking into some way to do that. And I think Senate Leader Phil Berger sort of said that was a ridiculous notion. State Health Secretary Mandy Cohen did say this week that they're looking at a way to kind of digitally keep track of it as well. You mentioned the vaccine card. If you're like me and you lose things, it will be good to have a system that keeps track of that also for you, so that you don't have to remember to take a picture on your phone and all that.
I think one of the things that you're going to see happen here, Mike, is the private sector is going to get really involved in this, because it behooves them to know. And obviously you have liability issues. And so when you talk about things like entertainment and sports and cruises and all those kinds of things, I think they're going to probably come up with some sort of system where you have a code or something so that people can get in quickly and you know who's there and who's been vaccinated.
And travel is going to be also a really important thing, because that's when you're around a lot of strangers.
Of course, there are these HIPAA regulations that preserve your medical privacy. But personally speaking, that's one piece of information that I'd be happy to give up if it meant getting on an airplane or getting on a cruise ship or going to a football game or something like that to get in with that. So that's the good news. The other good news is that health officials say that key metrics surrounding the COVID virus are improving. But they also say that hospitalizations are increasing in North Carolina. So are things improving or are they not, Claire?
I mean, it's like anything with the numbers, it's sort of hard to know. It's more important to look at kind of the overall trend. And we are way better than we were, you know, a couple months back. I think hospitalizations have been hovering around 1,000 this week. Certainly that's down from where it was before. But the important thing is to stress that, like, it's very easy to kind of relax and feel comfortable now that more and more people are getting vaccinated. But that doesn't mean that we should abandon things like masking and social distancing, because we are still in a race against the variants. I mean, yes, that is sort of all of the medical people that I've been talking to are saying, take your shot when you get a chance to, because we need to beat the variants.
The variant that you're talking about, particularly, there's one that's incredibly virulent and it's longer lasting. It's easier to catch. They're in all 50 states now. So that's what they're saying. Exactly. Get the shot as quickly as you can, because that helps us in the battle. But we're also hearing reports around the country now that younger people are the ones getting COVID and spreading it. And there is suspicion that this is happening in many cases because young people are now back playing indoor sports. And we've had conversations about this. If you get the virus because it's airborne and it comes from breathing and droplets that come from your mouth when you're talking or breathing, it seems to me that if you're playing indoor volleyball or wrestling or something like that, and you're not masked, you are doing that. And that seems to be what is happening. Do we have any examples of younger people in North Carolina getting or spreading this disease, Katie?
So I was going to caveat that with one quick thing. We asked Dr. Katie Pastoretti about this yesterday explicitly about younger people spreading the virus. And she noted that, yes, this is happening more, but it's also important to remember that older folks and residents of nursing homes were among the first people to be vaccinated. So if we have, you know, tackled the problem, so to speak, or tried to curb the spread among the oldest residents, it's only natural that younger people will see more instances of spread. So
I don't see the logic in that, to be honest with you. I'm not a medical person, but it seems to me, even though you're concentrating on older people, wouldn't there have been younger people getting it at the same time? Just because the older people are now vaccinated, the virus is not smart enough to say, oh, well, I'm not going to an old age home. I'll go over here to this school.
This was sort of dependent. I mean, this sort of goes back to the way that North Carolina decided to initially distribute the vaccine. Like Katie was saying, there was a movement or there were groups of people who thought that states should have started off vaccinating the spreaders as opposed to vaccinating the people most likely to get sick. Mm-hmm. And North Carolina opted to vaccinate people who were more likely to get seriously ill. Okay. And the other thing I was going to point out is, remember, the only vaccine authorized for people 16 and older is Pfizer. The other two are only for people 18 and older. And then also, we still don't have a vaccine authorized by the FDA for kids. So if these are kids playing indoor sports, like people under 16, that's going to be an issue of when do we have an emergency authorized vaccine for those folks.
Okay, but do we have any instances in this state of this happening? Okay.
I mean, that would be a question for health officials.
Okay. For months, a tent city grew on the outskirts of downtown until the county issued an order back in February to shut it down because of a rat infestation. There were about 140 people living in that encampment when it shut down. Those people, along with about 60 others, were given temporary housing in motels and places like that and were promised 3 months of these free lodgings. The end of that period was approaching when this week City Council approved a grant paying for 1 year of housing for some of these people. It comes from a $1.2 million grant. Where did that money come from?
This is from the original pool of CARES Act money from last year. So the $2.2 trillion and the city received, I think, $154.5 million. So it came out of that money. And so $2 million is going to go to United Way. There is a nonprofit housing group called Social Serve and then Catholic Charities, and they are going to collaborate on taking care of these 75 people in various ways, not just housing, but mental health and worker training and those kinds of things.
And Catherine Furman Sellers is the chief impact officer with United Way of the Central Carolinas. They're overseeing this program to help the former Tent City residents.
What we're going to do, working in partnership with several other organizations, is provide rental subsidy and supportive services to 75 individuals or families who are currently residing at the hotels who were formerly at the encampment.
So aside from housing, what other services are they talking about providing?
There are things like mental health, if you need help with substance abuse, going out and finding a job, developing your skills to get that job. I think they refer to these as wraparound services. In other words, you can't just take care of someone by giving them a place to live, but not helping them in the other aspects of life that they may be challenged by. So that's the idea.
And as we've heard on many other programs, on this program, that it all begins with housing. You have to have housing to have a stable life and to build from there. Glenn.
When we talk about Tent City, we often talk about it in the past tense. About a week ago, I got an email from a resident who lives near the Music Factory, mm-hmm. and she noted that since the demise of quote Tent City, a number of those residents have encamped under a bridge going toward the music factory. So I walked over there, and there does appear to be a growing encampment there. You know, I don't know if city officials are aware of that. I don't know if they're working to move them to housing. But I think we have to be careful when we, you know, talk about Tent City, you know, in the past tense. There's still very much a tent community scattered throughout the city.
And I mentioned that there were about 170 people living in that original tent city that we were talking about all through the late part of last year and the early part of this year. And 200 people were located to temporary housing when they shut that down. But only 75 individuals have been singled out to be helped by this grant of $1.2 million. How did they choose the 75? And what about the others?
The grant is $2.1 million. And the... Okay. The 75 that they chose are the candidates and people they think are most ready to take this step that can be helped most with not just the 1 year of rental subsidies, but the wraparound services that might get them into a more stable circumstance where they can take some steps on their own. Now, there also, Mike, is another piece of this where other CARES Act money will go to help the Salvation Army buy a hotel to provide shelter as well. And remember, you also have the county. I know this is terribly confusing because it's so bureaucratic, but you also have the county
right.
with its CARES Act money that's helping to pay for shelter for some of these Tent City residents as well. So basically, they are patching together all forms of money to get people taken care of. In other words, they're not just throwing people out. But I do want to say to Glenn's point, which is a very important one, no matter what you do, it is very difficult with a certain percentage of a homeless population to get them to accept shelter. So you have that challenge as well.
So I have less than a minute left. We had 140 people moved at least into these hotels for 3 months. That period is coming to an end. You just said they're not going to throw people out. And this new grant is for 75 people for 1 year. So what happens to the people who are not part of that grant when the 3 months expires? And what happens at the end of the year to the people who did get the grant? And I have 25 seconds.
I believe what they're doing is a month to month. In other words, you're not guaranteed, I think is how this is working.
When we come back, we'll talk about new crime statistics in North Carolina and take a look at what's going on in Georgia, which seems eerily familiar to those of us in North Carolina and more. Stay with us. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Claire Donnelly is here from WFAE News, where she reports on health issues and other things. Glenn Berkins is the founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Katie Peralta-Soloff, reporter for Axios Charlotte. CMPD reports the crime rate dropped in the first quarter of 2021. It's down 16% as compared to the first quarter of 2020. Claire, do we understand why?
So actually, I thought the most interesting part of the CMPD presser was that overall crime is down, but gun crime is up. So this kind of comes, you know, Charlotte has had a violent couple of years. And so I think according to CMPD Deputy Chief Stella Patterson, there were 25 homicides so far this year. And right now those only have a 40% clearance rate. I think it's interesting that overall crime is down, but violent crime is up.
Yeah,
well, I was going to add real quickly, Mike, of course, last year we had 120 homicides, which was a near record. And you're coming into the warmer months, so
right.
We're kind of trending right along with last year, which is very disturbing in terms of homicides.
Residential burglaries are down 33%, but there has been, as you said, a rise in gun crimes. Gun cases are up 7% across the board. Yesterday, President Biden announced steps that he was planning to take to address what he called an epidemic of gun violence in the country. Might those plans have any impact? He spent a lot of time talking yesterday about those so-called ghost guns. People buy parts through the mail and assemble their own gun that then has no serial number attached to it. And that's happening with increasing frequency. Will this have any impact at all?
I don't know how much that's going to impact street crime. A lot of the street crime is committed with stolen weapons. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. people leave guns in their cars. They leave guns in their homes unsecured. I don't know the extent to which things like ghost guns contribute to street crime, if you will. I don't get the impression that it's a big contributing factor to the type of crime that we're talking about here. Okay.
Georgia is one of many Republican-controlled states considering passing legislation or have already passed legislation that would make it more difficult to vote in Georgia. The law there is meeting with resistance now from the corporate sector. Major League Baseball pulled the All-Star game from Atlanta. Delta and Coca-Cola, both headquartered in Atlanta, have also issued strong statements against the legislation after issuing previous mamby-pamby statements about it. This is certainly reminiscent of what happened here. I'm going to say it. Here it comes. I'll put a quarter in the jar with HB2, with Charlotte losing the NBA All-Star game that year and other events and business locations and the like. Is what's happening in Georgia worse or about the same?
It's too soon to tell, in short. I think that probably a week ago, the conversation might have been different, honestly. It was last week exactly that the MLB decided to move its All-Star game out of Atlanta over the new voter restrictions. And as Atlanta's mayor said, basically, that's just the tip of the iceberg. So things to look out for are, of course, very familiar to us. You know, canceled job expansions. They could be, relocations of film productions. They could be, residents deciding not to move there. Everything that we experienced, they could see. And another thing that, we've talked endlessly about, economic development professionals in North Carolina is beyond those numbers, beyond the billions that, HB2 cost our economy, was the sort of unknowns that we just never reported on because we didn't ever hear about. There might have been companies, I need to expand my office. I'm looking to add another location. I'm not even going to add North Carolina to my list. Right. So there were endless numbers of those examples that surely Georgia is grappling with now. So I think that the fallout from a tourism perspective will be significant.
And you wrote earlier this week, Katie, about the reputational damage that North Carolina suffered from HB2. I'm curious if you think, since Georgia, Atlanta is a bigger city than Charlotte in terms of population, that they will suffer less of a reputational damage than we did, because outside of Charlotte and UNC basketball, most people in Peoria don't know who we are.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we could say yet. We're 5 years out from HB2. We just hit the anniversary, actually. And we're still paying for that reputational damage. I still have friends who will not come to North Carolina because of that reputation, and because HB2 wasn't fully repealed. Of course, it is ironic, and everybody in Charlotte will point out that it was Charlotte that tried to take the extra step to implement those protections for, gay and lesbian people and transgender individuals. But we were punished, so to speak, by the state legislature for those actions. And Atlanta, is a very progressive city, Democratic mayor, who is very against these new voting restrictions. So I think they would also say, don't punish Atlanta for Georgia's problem. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. The economic fallout is not going to single out one single city.
And as many critics have said of this kind of move, that this hurts the lower economic people more severely than it does the rich folks. Glenn.
Yeah. Well, I guess first I would remind you, Mike, that we are known. We're the gateway to Gastonia.
Thank you.
It's always good to keep that in mind. It's always a good table setter.
Okay.
The other thing, other thing that I would say is that I think Atlanta and Georgia might actually be hurt more, because this is a bigger story. This is a national story. This is emblematic of something that is happening throughout the South, throughout red states. So I think it has the potential to be much more detrimental than HB2 was here.
Yeah, and voting affects everybody. The HB2 law pretty much affected the LGBTQ community, and although they are sizable, they're not everybody in the population over 18 who can vote. And it also occurred to me yesterday that President Biden characterized this as Jim Crow on steroids, and I don't recall anybody at that level of government nationally commenting on HB2 in North Carolina, and that was during the Obama administration. I just don't remember that happening. It may have. A man named Ronnie Long spent 44 years in prison, during all of that time, trying to prove his innocence for a crime he did not commit. 44 years. Last August, the courts ruled that Ronnie Long had been wrongfully convicted, and they set him free, and the state anteed up $750,000 in compensation. But Long and his attorney both say that is not enough. Mr. Long.
$750,000 is a lot of money. But $750,000 ain't what I would call compensation for 44 years of a man's life.
That came from an interview with the Charlotte Observer. He points out that the state took his 20s, his 30s, his 40s, and his 50s. Both his parents died while he was locked up on a crime he did not commit. Those are incalculable losses. So how did the state arrive at $750,000 as compensation?
I believe it's capped at that amount, isn't it? So 44 years, I'm not sure what that equals per year, 750,000 divided by 44, but
I think it's $17,000.
Pretty meager. The state will pay someone, WCNC reported, who is wrongfully convicted, $50,000 a year for the time that they spend in prison, but the amount is capped at $750,000, which means that Ronnie Long was essentially, he got nothing for more than 2/3 of the time that he spent in there. So
he's planning to fight this. Can that fight be successful? Don't know.
Not sure.
The 12 jurors who found him guilty came from what has been described as a tampered pool of potential jurors. Will those responsible for the tampering be prosecuted now?
Oh, that's a good question.
Are you talking about prosecutors?
Whoever tampered with the jury pool. Yeah. I mean, if they're still alive. All right, well, we'll move on because there's no answer to that question yet, but maybe we'll know in a couple of months. Filled in for me last week for a couple of programs, Eric, and you spent an hour talking about the state of Uptown and the result of the pandemic. And this week, Katie, you wrote about one of Eric's guests on one of those programs, James Mack, who is looking for a new location for his jewelry store, which is currently located at the Epicenter. And evidently finding new space is a problem, given all of the closed businesses and all of the empty office space Uptown. Why?
That's the question that Mr. Mack is asking as well. I mean, we reported on this as a problem that not just James Mack is experiencing, but a number of Black-owned businesses for a number of reasons. And they're given a lot of different excuses for why it's hard to find prime real estate in especially hot areas like Uptown and Southend. They are told that, sometimes their products don't fit the market. That's when Mac has heard. He has also heard that he needs to bring on investors to solidify his business. So it's a lot of reasons. Sometimes they just get the runaround.
Did this problem predate the pandemic, or is this as a result of the pandemic?
It absolutely predated the pandemic, but the pandemic just highlighted the fact that there is all of this open commercial space, and yet it's still difficult to land it. So it's counterintuitive. You would think that because you know, leasing agents need to fill these spaces, yeah, they would be receptive to all businesses, but it does not seem to be the case.
We're about a month away from something that is going to happen that's really going to impact this community at large. And I know, although it's going to happen next month, I want to give people a warning, because if you don't get the newspaper or you didn't happen to see this story on television, you may not be aware that beginning on May the 6th, the South Carolina Department of Transportation will be replacing the entire deck on the southbound side of the Catawba River Bridge on I-77, rerouting traffic to the northbound lanes, closing exits at Sutton Road and I think 32, the one that goes off into Rock Hill, and closing entrance roads onto I-70. It's going to be a nightmare, in short.
You make it sound so appealing.
Well, it is, because all the alternate routes are surface roads, are through neighborhoods and places like that. What are people who commute? What are travelers coming through to go to Florida in May going to do?
They're going to sit in traffic. I mean, to your point, Mike, they're either that route or the alternate routes. There's nowhere to go. So this is going to be a mess. It's going to be at least 3 weeks, as you said, all four lanes taken out of service. And so you're going to have two lanes each way northbound. This is essentially between Rock Hill and Fort Mill. There's really no way to escape it. To your point, it's going to be highly unpleasant. I think that I-77, that stretch, 120,000 cars a day. So this is easy math as to why you'll be in a bottleneck.
So this will be backed up to Richmond. We'll figure that out when it happens, I guess. No LaMelo Ball news this week, but we do have basketball news. Let's start with UNC Chapel Hill. They already have a new head men's basketball coach to replace the retiring Roy Williams, and he is no stranger to the program. He is Hubert Davis.
You can't do this job unless you're a Carolina guy. It's impossible. You can't coach here. You can't recruit here. You can't work here unless you have been here. You've experienced it. You have lived it.
He's actually talking there about his approach to hiring staff, and he called those qualifications non-negotiable. So guess where the staff is coming from? Andy, but he also says the same description applies to him. What's his story for those people who don't know him?
Well, Hubert Davis, his uncle was a star. Walter Davis played at UNC, and then Hubert Davis played under Dean Smith. He was recruited by Dean Smith and Roy Williams right before Roy Williams went to Kansas, and then he went on to play 12 years in the NBA, and he has been a part of Roy Williams' staff since 2012. And one of the most notable things is he will be the first African-American head coach of the men's basketball program in Chapel Hill.
Given the long tenure of Dean Smith and Roy Williams, I was actually surprised to find, because that's about 150 years, I was surprised to find that he's only going to be the 19th coach of the Tar Heels. I thought it'd be much less than that. The Panthers have a new quarterback coming our way this season, former New York Jets quarterback Sam Darnold, and this has turned out to be controversial. Why?
Well, anytime you talk about a quarterback, it's going to be controversial unless it's Tom Brady, pretty much, or Patrick Mahomes. The Panthers have been looking for a quarterback, obviously, for several years, with Cam Newton being hurt and then leaving. Teddy Bridgewater did not have a great year, but so much of this, Mike, is about who is around you. This is a little bit of a gamble, but the consensus seems to be that the Panthers have not given up a tremendous amount so they can take this chance with Sam Darnold, who's all of 23 years old.
Wow. Let's talk about LaMelo Ball.
Please, let's do.
Only because he's out for the season with a wrist injury, but because he was there, the team has been playing better this year, and for the first time in a very long time, they actually have maybe a shot at being in a playoff game. And as a result of the team's success, the TV ratings were up. I didn't even know they were still on television. How up are they?
Boy, I bet the Hornets are happy to hear that. Somebody get a memo out to Mike. The games are on TV. They have more than doubled the ratings, which sounds great and is great. However, they have been really low in terms of viewership for a myriad of reasons. But they see hope on the horizon. And as you said, Mike, LaMelo Ball is always a ray of hope for you and others. So there
and to
go.
Close the show on another up note, yesterday the Charlotte Symphony announced after a year of concerts canceled due to COVID, they would be returning to the Belk Theater live with an audience on April 24th. They have other performances set for May. The current one is only open to season subscribers, but this is a crack in the door. This is the beginning of returning to live performance. That's good news. Claire Donnelly, Glenn Birkins, Katie Peralta-Soloff, Eric Spanberg, thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.